Good evening. I apologize for being up, looming over you like this. I'd much rather look up at you than look down, but I just had a shot in my knee, and it's to make me much more flexible and better working. So it works great. It worked great last year, so I'm having it again. And I just had it about 2 hours ago, so I thought I'd better baby it a little bit. It's so amazing what they can do now. Just patch you all up and send you out again. Before we start with Dogen, I wanted to go over the etiquette of doing the service briefly. It's not crucial that we do it exactly right. I mean, in some Zen places, you're supposed to mind your P's and Q's and be exactly right. But it's very nice if everyone is more or less doing the same thing. It's like a dance. It makes the feeling of everything fitting. It's like Orioki. You can do it any old way, but there's beauty and a kind of nourishment in working it out all together in community. So when we do the chanting, everybody faces each other. When you do the bowing, you bow to the altar from wherever you are. So you bow to the altar, and then you stand back and you make two lines. And do the chanting that way, and focus not on the meaning of the words so much as how the sound is coming up through your body and how other people's sound is coming into you, so that it's a listening practice as well as a deep expression. We use a different part of our brain to chant. It's why most spiritual practices have some kind of chanting or singing, because singing and chanting uses something back here, the Broca. I've forgotten. I'm very bad about the names of it, but you can tell the difference, and it's to open us up, to open the other side of us, you could say. Then after the second set of bows, and that's stepping up and aiming at the altar again. We bow to the altar, which is the focus, a projection of the focus of our own triple treasure, you could say, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, truth. Then you step back and let's see, how does it work? After the bows, you do a little bow. We all do a little bow. And then I step back, and you all step back and bow to each other. And then I come back, and I bow to my seat. And am I getting this right?
A little bow. Our first bow, isn't it to the altar?
The first bow is to the altar.
The second is we should be back aligned facing each other.
Yes, you face each other and bow to each other. And then when I turn around, we put our hands this way and bow to each other this way. So it sounds complicated, but it's not really. The only weird thing about it is that I bow to my cushion while you all are bowing to each other. And one more thing is that at the very beginning, when we're in Gassho, to begin, that's my job as Doshi. So everybody else chants this way. I think that's it. Are there questions?
So we don't do this when we start the chant. You're the only one that does
this. I'm the only one who's doing this.
we've been doing you.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Okay.
And I haven't been very... but, you know, if you go to some other Zen center, you'll see that's the way it's done. So you should know.
Kenyan is wrapping around. The thumb is on the inside, right?
The thumb is on the inside of the left hand, like that. And then you put your right thumb on top of it and wrap your hand around. So you have a sort of knot that you hold right here. And then you're balanced. You're really completely balanced, and it's a bit like this, you know. It's very condensed. It's just being completely your own, complete upright breathing piece of bones and blood.
Bell ring twice, and I used to just gassho on the first bell, but it's the second one that we're to gassho on.
When it's over?
When for Kenyan, for the two bells before we get on the cushion.
Just getting up.
Mm-hmm. When it's over, yeah. When the sitting period is over.
When the sitting is over and the bell rings to get up, if there are two. Two bells.
Two for Kenyan. It's the second bell, I guess, for gassho.
That's right. That's when you gassho and get up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
People are usually sitting when the second bell is rung anyway. So
right. But that's when, when you're at your seat then. But I used to gassho on the first.
That happens in Sashin, though, when we're doing one sit after the other. In our sit here, there's only one bell that rings after the sitting.
Yeah.
But to end the period.
Right.
To end it. So to get up for Kin.
Oh, I see.
To get up for Kin. When you get up for Kin, you got
when
shown
you come
the
second bell is
rung.
Which naturally happens, correct? Because
By
the time the second bell is rung, everyone has stood up.
No, on the second bell, you're still sitting and you're bowing.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I used to just, whenever I heard a bell, I just did this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find this helpful. So when you're visiting different Zen centers, I feel like I blend in a little better instead of looking like this person is bumping into each other, which I do still do.
But it also helps just to imagine that you're, I always say, eating dinner with the Queen of England, and you know you don't know everything, so you just keep watching and seeing what everybody else is doing and try not to make too many mistakes. It doesn't really matter. It's just, you could say it's convention, but as I say, there's more to it than that. It's how to create the space for this. And how to appreciate this space.
So what? We no longer do this, we're going to do this when we do our sutra. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So no more cut this stuff out, right?
Well, you do that sometimes, but not...
On a Thursday?
You always make me laugh.
Sometimes when my shoulders are really sore, and it's probably because I'm either leaning back or something,
mm-hmm.
If I were to lay my hands here, is there any preferred mudra, or if this is the mudra that is most...
Well, the alternative to this is this, and that helps the shoulders. But you want to hold it up if you can. And if you're having a lot of trouble, find something to put in your lap so that you can rest your hands on it. And the shoulders are a constant problem in a lot of monasteries. They have somebody who gives massage to the teacher, it always seems sort of unfair that the teacher gets the massage and nobody else does, but it's because the shoulders are so problematic. It's just always something going on there. I saw a new physical therapist not long ago, and she asked me to show her what I do, and so I showed her the Zazen position, and she said, "Oh, your shoulders are way up." And she said, "Drop your shoulders," and boom, and my whole mudra moved way over into the middle. When the shoulders are up, it moves over out of place. So it makes a difference. I was surprised. I thought I was sitting so well.
And you never switch hands?
No, you don't switch hands.
Feet?
You do switch feet.
But not hands.
But not hands. The feet make a difference in how your whole spine is. The hands don't make any difference really at all. You're not changing the rest of your torso at all.
But it won't send us to hell if we change hand positions, right?
Well, I think it's just a convention with the hands, because there's some traditions that have it the other way, with the left hand holding the right hand. So it's just how we, it's etiquette in the Soto Zen tradition.
Does any of the hand movements come from any legacy of martial arts? Because this is like, you know, in the years of martial arts, you think that in the years of Zen and martial arts also intertwine each other.
Yeah.
Like when Buddha went over to China, they molded, I think, martial arts into the studies and blended it with Zen.
The first teacher from India who went to China, the first meditation teacher, Bodhidharma, is said to have brought some kind of martial art with him. And that was part of his practice. They still do it at where he was, you know, 2,000 years later. So, yeah, I'm sure so. But then the martial arts go back to spiritual practices also. So it's, you know, the comportment of the human body and the effect that how we use our body on the mind, I'm sure goes as far back as the mists of time. We're always studying that and finding the best way. Shall we read some Dogen? Did we read number 6 last time? We did, didn't we?
The long one.
So we're on a little, very, very short one, and then a fairly short one. Two short ones.
So start with number 7.
7.
Page 3. Some people exhorted Dogen to go to Eastern Japan for the propagation of Buddhism. He replied, "No. If someone had an aspiration for the Buddhist teaching, he would cross mountains, rivers, and seas to come and study it. Even if I were to go to exhort people without that aspiration, it is uncertain as to whether they would listen. Would I just be fooling people for my own material support? Would it be because of greed for wealth? Because this is distressing to the body, my feeling is to let it be."
So we don't exhort in this practice. We don't proselytize in any way. It's not a part of, you know, sometimes people get thrilled and go home and tell their parents about the whole thing, and it doesn't really work that way. Much better to let the practice itself speak in your own life and show itself, rather than trying to talk about it with other people. And as teachers, we never go out and try to drum up business, you know, try to find people who might be interested. It's much more that as a teacher, it's like the Sufi practice where go and sit down in a town somewhere and become a cobbler or a tailor or a cook and just begin to get to know people and begin to have some kind of effect and begin to grow a kind of garden of relationship. I think we're all doing that in our life, in our work. It's not obvious and we don't press it on anyone, but the practice itself has much more of an effect than any kind of words would have to persuade people. Not that we don't talk about it if somebody asks us, but it's not something that we press on anybody. Exhorting people, I can just see. Ladies and gentlemen, I have this remarkable thing to tell you. That was short. Anything about that? Donna Lynn?
The other thing that stands out for me is he said, you know, he's not only going to proselytize or advertise, but he's not going to go somewhere else.
Yes.
He's going to go in another country.
Yes.
That's what I really got from it.
Yes.
It's not like some of the older religions and traditions did.
Still do. The Mormons go out. The Mormons go all over the world. Yeah, that's right. That's right. If people are thirsty for the Dharma, they will come. So from my side, I go if I'm invited only. And I do go far, and sometimes I think that's a little strange to do that, to go so far away. But it's in my teacher's tradition, in our teacher's tradition. So he created those places, and there are people there who remember him and long for that connection. So I go. Number 8.
He also said, people who study the way should not read the books of the scholastic Buddhist schools, nor study the outside, non-Buddhist classics. If you must read, read the recorded sayings of the Zen patriarchs and the like. As for the rest, you should put them away for the time being.
Meditating monks of recent times are fond of literary things. To compose verses and write sermons, this is wrong. Even without expressing it in verse, one may write what one thinks, what he thinks. Though the literary style may not be polished, or one may write down the teaching. A person who is so lacking in the mind of the way that he would refuse to read it because it is crude would only delight in words and would fail to grasp the principle, even if there were exquisitely clever phrases in a highly polished literary style.
Since this is something that I had originally studied fondly since childhood, even now from time to time, beautiful phrases from the outer classics occur to me, and things like the
winds, make it up.
Something, something. also appear to me, yet because I consider it to be pointless, I think that in fact it should be utterly abandoned.
That's interesting, isn't it? He was a very unusual composer of words or composer of phrases, and his writings were in a kind of colloquial Japanese, kind of mix of Japanese. He could write brilliant, beautiful, literary Chinese, but he also started writing in colloquial Japanese that is still to this day very difficult to translate into English, because he used such he just twisted words and flipped them around and used all kinds of tricky ways to bring things up that you would never think, and continually try to open up the language as he was trying to open up the mind. He was a poet. There's a whole a book of the translations of his poetry now. Very touching, very beautiful, very lovely poems that he wrote. So it's interesting to hear about the beautiful phrases that he was giving up, but he never did quite give it up. And use that skill to write about the Dharma. Kogan always suggested that we write our own sutras, or write our own version of the precepts, our own version of the paramitas, our own version of the Heart Sutra. He said the West should create our own expression of the Dharma and not depend on all the old words. That new sutras should show up. I think we're a little too new for it still. The Dharma hasn't been in the West long enough yet, I think. But I bet we're working on it. It certainly feels like it. Understand that this first paragraph about reading, he's saying you should put them away for the time being. So he's talking to the young monks, and he's not saying don't ever read anything except the patriarchs, but if you're going to practice seriously, then put away the novels and the songs and the poems, and just practice for the time being. Meditating monks don't get involved with literary things and verses and sermons and all that kind of show-off stuff in a way. But there are different stages of practice, so that if you plunge in and become a meditating monk for a while, then you eventually walk into another phase where maybe those things are important again. That certainly happened to me. I just stopped reading for a while completely. And when you first begin to practice, it seems like a real good idea, because reading feeds us wonderfully. My mother used to say she'd rather read than eat. And I sometimes feel like that myself. But it also cultivates the linear side of our mind more than we need when we're really getting into meditation practice. Meditation practice, we drop our interest in how the mind is thinking about things for the time being, in order to cultivate the other side, the backward step, the background, you could say. And it's nice that he says, even if it's written crudely, if it's true, don't sneer at it. I like that a lot. I think that's important for us to remember. We don't have to try to be perfect with everything. Just express the truth of us. The truth as we are, as we know. That's what everybody recognizes and knows.
Like stages of practice. I mean, how do you know it's...
You don't.
All right, you read? Okay.
It's intuitive.
Okay. I mean...
It's not written down anywhere.
You just feel it.
You do. You do. And that's why... But in Sesshin, when you get informal practice, if you went to a monastery, you would not bring novels. In Sesshin, we don't read or write. As long as the sitting is going on, and for that 7-day or 10-day period, there's no reading or writing. I used to hang sheets over the books at Chikoji so that people wouldn't even be tempted by the books, because there they are and you just naturally fall into them. But otherwise, in your own life, there was a period in my life when I just didn't read anymore, which was radical. And then slowly I got back into it again. Maybe that doesn't happen to everybody either, but... I mean, you're a writer. A lot of us are writers in here, so... It's...
I kind of had the same kind of... experience, like,
yeah,
not wanting to, or having the feeling that maybe, like, reading the fiction, maybe, or, I don't know, wasn't such a good thing. I don't know, but it's hard to explain, but...
Yeah.
I think it comes down to centering, I don't know, like, groundedness.
That's a big part of it, yeah. It's different for everyone.
So I don't like to read. And I never like to read. And I thought that was a problem, like I wasn't read to or something. Or is it just that I read in my job? Like that I use my brain so much that I don't want to, like, read an
author.
Mm-hmm. I have no desire.
Yes.
Like in the study group and stuff, I get it done. And it's fine. Yeah.
Different strokes for different folks. I don't think there's any rule for it at all. Some people are completely inspired by reading. For me, it's like walking into somebody else's life and world and mind.
I really
have
to.
Yeah, but you see... He lived a long time ago and left this artifact behind. So it just depends. It really does. There's no rule. Samia?
Did the not reading for you come up by itself, or did somebody tell you it's a good idea to draw the reading?
It came by itself. I think I just got so interested in what was happening to me sitting, and I just didn't want to get in the way of it. And I felt that all the words were getting in the way of it.
Do you come in and out of it now, or do you read and sit?
I do read and sit.
All the time?
Yeah.
You don't... The feeling of not wanting to read doesn't come up anymore.
No. I probably should. I have a stack of books to read.
For me, it manifested in a different way. It was the same for me in haiku. When I was introduced to haiku and was learning to write it, I really enjoyed it, and you know, I wrote some decent haiku. You know, even though it was crude, it was true, I guess, in a way. And then I just started reading everything I could get my hands on. You know, every book on technique. You know, all these poems from Japanese and Japanese and around the world that wrote haiku, and it got to, I couldn't write anymore. It was just terrible because I was always thinking of, you know, the rules, and it's the same thing when I started Zen in a way. I was more aware of it, but it was like there's so many different attitudes, there's so many different traditions. Even writing haiku, is it three lines, one line? Is it a break? Is it, you have to have nature in it? And it was the same way for me and when I was reading about, and why I looked for a teacher when I started studying Buddhism. You know, am I reincarnated or am I not? Am I sitting straight up or am I, you know, holding my hands this way, or am I, you know, supposed to be chanting more? You know, it was like, again, it was all, it just messed me up for my desire to read about everything and to have the knowledge. And so I dropped haiku for a couple of years, and I just stopped reading anything about haiku until I felt like I was introduced again to it, until I regained my beginner's mind. And for me, it was in Dokusan, when I was sharing with Angie some of the things of my confusion coming up with reading. I'd be asking her all these questions. Well, why did you say this? Or anything? And she finally just said, well, you just stop reading. And I did. I think I stopped for a couple of years.
A long time.
It's not that I just didn't read anything. It's just I wasn't reading anything. And even now, I rarely read outside of my tradition right now, outside of Dogen and so it was both. It was a natural experience happening, and I needed someone that had the experience to help me.
I was finding like I was like gorging on the words, and it was like very the thought, you know, like that was rising. It wasn't necessarily, it was off center. It you know, kind of looking back on it, it was like more reactionary, like just so constantly seeking another book. It was kind of like that. So
I'm just very simple minded. It doesn't take much to confuse me.
Angie, is it not true that study is part of our practice?
Yes, indeed. Yes. But when you first go in as a monk to the monastery, you put all your books aside. So, as I said, we're in a different position from that. But when we go to Sesshin, we're going into the monastery. And when we come out and go home and do our life, then we have to choose how to do. And sometimes, even in our life, we sort of lead a monastic life for a while. And then we have those same values, but not always. It just depends. Then we're free to decide for ourselves. And certainly, at a certain point, we begin, I think, to study because it's a completely natural thing for us to do. And in regular Soto Zen, it's very set up so that you present certain things at a certain time, and everything is in stages that are by the years. So you're supposed to wait to read a certain thing until you're at a certain age in in practice. And you're supposed to wait to do Doan until you're at a certain stage in practice. And Koban never had any of that. It's very artificial, but you can control people that way much better. If you have a large group, it's much easier to control the group. But in a small group, it's not necessary. But the necessity for study grows up in us, I think. If we get really into sitting, we begin to need to. The need comes from ourself, not from somebody else. Then we start looking around. What is there out there? You know, who else knows about this? That's really why we study. Who else knows about this? And then, oh, there is somebody. Now, he knew. It's incredible.
What about writing, Angie, and session? Is that the same thing as Donovan's talking about, that it's the composing mind getting
yes.
involved?
And, yes.
Is there a place for that, though, too?
Not in Sesshin, at least theoretically.
Just to let it all be there.
Yes.
And not to record.
Yes. That's real hard for some of us, I think. But that's the ideal. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Wendy's wonderful account of a week of Sesshin is just lovely.
And she invited it to Sesshin.
You did not?
No.
Well, it was a lovely reflection of.
It was really sweet.
Beautiful.
Very sweet. I was planning to write about a week or so after.
Uh-huh.
It was pretty fresh.
Yes. And you've picked the bright places.
There was more.
I bet there was. Let's see, it's a little after 8, so we should...